This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The candidates have moved on to other states, but we're going to take one more look back at the presidential primary in Michigan with Western Michigan University political science professors John Clark and Peter Wheelhauer. Thank you both for being here.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Gordon.
So let's start on the Democratic side. Bernie Sanders won Michigan after almost every poll showed that Hillary Clinton was on her way to a pretty comfortable victory. There were some clever leads and headlines that people had. Harry Hinton in 538 said that Bernie Sanders made folks like me eat a stack of humble pie on Tuesday night. Susan Demas, who is the editor of Inside Michigan Politics, says that the Bernie Sanders win was the sort of unbelievable conventional wisdom-defying upset that makes covering elections so much fun, and I called it wrong. And certainly Susan Demas and everybody else was not alone in that camp. So if you were looking for a historical comparison, is there another election that you look at and say, this one compares to, in terms of the big upset where the polls seemed to show somebody else was going to win?
Well, I think actually, and maybe surprisingly, there are a lot of those kinds of elections in the primary season. And when we think about presidential politics, and part of the reason is that, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more later on, the difficulty in polling primary electorates, and there's sort of multiple difficulties, and I'm sure we'll return to that in a minute. But the other thing is there's sort of a national narrative that takes place. And then there's the fact that these contests are decided in individual states. And sometimes the narrative within the state doesn't match what happens at the national level. And if we were to go back and look in sort of relatively recent history, post-1968 history is what we political scientists sort of think about as the modern era of primary elections. When we get down to two candidates, this sort of thing happens quite a lot. And that happens whether it's Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford in 76 or Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy in 1980 or Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in 2008. When we get down to just two, sometimes we get these kinds of surprises. That being said, this was surprising and it was a big surprise.
And I think this is also the case when you have candidates who don't have a lot of support among the people who most likely to be polled, but who have a lot of kind of under-the-radar grassroots support, especially Bernie Sanders, who spends a lot of time in the state, especially in college towns, with an electorate that's relatively unpredictable, is this young block of voters. And I think it makes a big difference.
Bernie Sanders also, in a lot of ways, as I saw it, I think in Gongwer, flipped the script here. He ran a Democratic campaign, which really isn't supposed to be that successful. Hillary Clinton won the more populous counties where there's the most people, and the saying goes, well, you win Wayne County, you win Oakland County, maybe throw in Macomb, which you won narrowly, and that should do it, at least for a Democratic nomination. But Bernie Sanders got a lot of people to go to the polls in areas where Democrats normally don't do well, but he got them to go and vote for him.
Well, and I think one of the big picture narratives here in terms of Michigan politics is the dramatic changes in population in Detroit Metro over the last 15 years. Detroit has lost 750,000 people in the last 15 years. That's a heck of a lot of Democratic voters. Maybe just the game plan for Michigan for Democrats moving forward just has to take that into account. And Bernie Sanders seems to have tapped into that.
Now, having said that, almost a quarter of the Democratic primary vote was from Wayne County. And so it still is an enormous, enormous population center and of enormous importance to Democrats. But I think Pete's right. That decline is something that that many of us didn't completely keep up with. And the fact that Wayne County was not the first to report their votes meant that for a long time, a lot of us were just waiting to see what would happen there.
Exactly. When I was in the news studio on election night, everybody, all the experts, all the commentators, we were all saying, well, we just have to wait on that Democratic stronghold where everybody presumed that Hillary Clinton was going to be quite strong. And her performance there was okay, but it was not a blowout even in Detroit Metro.
That's right.
And Bernie Sanders did better with African-American voters in Michigan than he has done in other states. I mean, does this, if you are in the Hillary Clinton camp, make you worry a bit that perhaps the dynamics of the race have shifted in some way that could lead to a more surprising result when it's all said and done?
Well, I think if you're in a campaign, you worry about almost everything.
Right.
But in this case,
should.
Yeah, you should. That's right. And some folks are suggesting, at least, that the Clinton campaign didn't worry enough in Michigan, that they didn't spend enough time here, they didn't spend enough money here, they thought they had it locked up. Sanders wasn't completely all in Michigan, but pretty darn close, because his path to the nomination had to include a good showing in Michigan, and he got it.
Well, he did best, obviously, among white males within the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton did best among black females. But what's interesting is when we look at the exit polls in this, among Democrats who thought that racial conditions in the country and in the state had gotten worse over the last few years, Bernie Sanders won that chunk of the electorate. The people who thought that race relations had gotten better or about the same, they stayed with Hillary Clinton. So there does seem to be some underlying dissatisfaction with the status quo.
John brought up the issue earlier of how accurate polls are, and there have been questions over the years about with more people relying on cell phones. And those are tougher to call to get people to answer. Of course, there's caller ID, and some people, if they don't recognize the name, or maybe if they recognize it's a polling firm, they decide just not to answer. And this, of course, in Michigan, we can look at the Republican side and say the pollsters were pretty much spot on. But does this result in the Clinton-Sanders race, especially when we know that Bernie Sanders was relying more on younger people who are less likely to have a landline? Does it raise questions going forward about how good we can expect polling to be?
Well, I think that we saw the first indications of this even in 2008 when Barack Obama's support in Iowa was underestimated because the models of public opinion pollsters were primarily based on landlines, and which overstated Hillary's support. What we saw this year is that the one daily tracking poll that was publishing nearly every day in the last few days leading up to the Michigan primary relied solely on landlines. And to the extent that national poll averages such as pollster.com or Real Clear Politics relied on that one polling firm who only used landlines and didn't weight their respondents, we're going to get a poor estimate. And that was really surprising, but it's a lesson learned.
And I think polling in nomination contests is tricky to begin with. For one thing, there are certainly people who are plugged into the campaign and have been for months. But even typical primary voters really don't start to pay attention until the campaign gets to their state. And that means here in Michigan, it was after Super Tuesday, leading up 1 week to the Michigan primary. And part of that reason is you really don't know what the field's going to look like until then. And so there's not a lot of reason to be heavily invested.
For instance, Jeb Bush dropped out before
Ben Carson. And for folks who voted in the Michigan presidential primary, on both sides, there were long lists of candidates, most of whom, back in December, were still contesting the nomination, but at this point, not so much. So that's one thing. There's sort of this moving target thing. Many of the polls that were being relied on were polls that really were being conducted before the campaign got here in terms of advertising, in terms of candidate visits, and in terms of attention. The other thing is that many of these surveys had really small samples. And, polling is expensive under the best of circumstances. And when you're trying to do it, sort of in tight windows, it becomes even more expensive. And so if we were to, sort of have really good, really reliable polling data up to the election on a daily basis, we might have seen the trend occurring. We probably would have. But we didn't, and we probably won't in states moving forward. People are talking about Florida and Ohio and what's happening there, but most of the polling that they're relying on is polling that now is at least a week old, if not weeks old. That's not really very helpful in nominating contests.
And I think that we just can't really emphasize enough how important this problem of who shows up in a public opinion poll, who is vastly underrepresented. You're going to miss young people in landline polls, and you're going to miss late breakers, people who make their decision at the last moment, even if for the Democrats, we've known who the main candidates are going to be for a month or 6 weeks. Now the question is, do you know who's going to make a decision at the final call? And those seem to be breaking in favor of the non-establishment non-frontrunner candidates such as John Kasich or in the case of Michigan, certainly Bernie Sanders.
And that was less of a problem on the Republican side. Certainly there was some late movement with Rubio's decline and Kasich's rise. But for the most part, that field was pretty stable, and the surveys did a reasonably good job of contacting the right kinds of people so that their survey samples reflected the Republican voting population in the presidential primary.
That might be an interesting thing to really think about a little bit more, is whether the Republican electorate actually is easier to poll and is more predictable to poll, easier to model, than is the current Democratic electorate, especially with an insurgent, really different kind of candidate on the extreme end of the Democratic Party like Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just really hard to predict that.
Let's transfer to the Republicans a bit by here. I'll go back to an historical analogy. The last real upset in a Michigan primary was 2000 when John McCain beat George W. Bush, despite the fact that most of the elected Republicans in this state, including the governor then, John Engler, were firmly in the Bush camp. And that was not a case where the polls were that off, although Bush was expected to win. But I recall talking to your colleague, Kevin Corder, at the time, and him saying, look, Bush has got the organization. He's got the support going forward. The Michigan primary is not going to derail George W. Bush from getting the Republican nomination. That turned out to be exactly right. Is that the sort of thing, if you want to comfort yourself for a moment and take a second to not worry in the Hillary Clinton camp, that you might think right now that Hillary Clinton still has the infrastructure, she has the support, she has the organization, she's got many elected Democrats in her corner. Going forward, she might be able to look back at Michigan in a couple weeks and think that it was just a speed bump on the way to the Democratic nomination.
I heard an estimate on NPR a couple of days ago, or the day of the Michigan primary, that suggested that in order for Bernie Sanders to actually win the pledged delegates, moving forward, he has to pick up about 58% of the remaining delegates. That means he has to win 58 to 60% of the Democratic primary voters in every race here on out. It just seems really unlikely that that's going to happen. Is he going to do better than he has up to this point? Perhaps. But can he overcome Hillary Clinton's very modest pledged delegate lead and her extraordinary superdelegate lead? I just think that it's, unfortunately for Sanders fans, I think it's unlikely.
Yeah, there are really two ways that we can talk about how you win in a sequential series of primaries like this. One way you win is you pick up the most delegates. And it turns out that at the end of the day, because of her overwhelming success in Mississippi, Hillary Clinton actually widened the delegate lead over Sanders, and not the other way around. The other way you win is by shaping what happens in future nominating contests in other states so that you're affecting the delegate outcomes there. In that sense, you know, Sanders got a real big boost. But as Pete says, it depends in large measure on whether or not he can turn that consistently into delegate wins in every state moving forward. And the superdelegate issue, I mean, sometimes people get a little nervous about superdelegates, but these are elected officials, party officials. They make up around 15% of the total delegates to the Democratic convention. They're overwhelmingly in support of Hillary Clinton because she's a Democrat. And one of the fascinating things to me about this race, both sides, quite frankly, is the, you know, I'm sort of an unreconstructed political party scholar. That's how I cut my teeth in the discipline. And I'm from Indiana. That's sort of a traditional political party state. And the fact that that Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat, couldn't vote for himself in some of these primary states because he's not a Democrat. Donald Trump maybe is a Republican, but certainly not a Republican who's been a Republican for very long. You know, as somebody who thinks in terms of political parties, that sort of makes my head want to explode. But that superdelegate lead, at this point at least, looks decisive, and it looks like an extremely high burden. If it turns out that Sanders ends up with more delegates from the primaries and caucuses where delegates are allocated, then we might see a lot of switching on the superdelegate side. But that gives her a margin that it's going to be difficult to overcome.
I would say that this is a real risk for the Democratic Party. Let's say that Bernie Sanders does pull out some important victories and ends up getting more pledged delegates than Hillary Clinton does, but still not a majority. Because he's an insurgent, and even though he's not a Democrat, he is an insurgent within the party. Mm-hmm. He is mobilizing a lot of new voters into the Democratic Party in a way that was comparable to what Barack Obama did. But Barack Obama was not playing the anti-Democratic Party, anti-establishment card the way that Bernie Sanders is. And I think the risk for the Democrats is if they get to the convention, nobody has a majority, but Bernie Sanders has slightly more than Hillary Clinton, and the superdelegates continue to support Hillary Clinton, they risk in the general election alienating those new people who are not lifelong Democrats but have been mobilized by Bernie Sanders.
What's remarkable about this election year is we're seeing the exact same thing on the other side.
Yes, we are.
Where we've got the traditional party and the party establishment not necessarily settling on a single candidate, at least not yet. But working very hard right now to try and do something to slow down Donald Trump. If, again, we get to the Republican convention, whether or not Trump has enough delegates to get the nomination, if the party establishment doesn't coalesce around him, that also could create problems for them moving forward. And quite frankly, if either Sanders or Trump is elected president of the United States, the way that, the Republicans and Democrats in Congress respond to them very much sets up the future for the political parties in a way that, even as an unreconstructed parties guy, hard for me to get a finger on at this point.
Well, is there anything that if you are part of the Stop Trump movement, and the Lord knows there's lots of people in lots of different parts of the Republican Party that are trying to find a way to do that right now. Did Michigan tell you anything that you can use going forward into other states about how to cut into Donald Trump's strength at this point?
I don't think actually that anybody is cutting into Donald Trump's strength. I think that early on, people were talking about a ceiling for Donald Trump, but I think what you were seeing were kind of the core Donald Trump supporters, anti-immigrant, low education, economically distressed, white middle class, lower middle class Republicans. What we're seeing as other candidates have been dropping off is that some of their support has been going to some other candidates, but some of their support has been going to Donald Trump. And I think that going forward, what you'll see is that Donald Trump's support will grow to look more and more just like a normal Republican's support, whereas earlier he had kind of a distinctive image in terms of the kind of voter that was looking at him. But more and more, he's just going to start looking more and more like a generic Republican.
That certainly could be the case. At this point, though, we really don't know whether there's a ceiling for Trump, or if there is, what that ceiling is. There have only been a handful of states where he's been, you know, close to 50% of the Republican voters, which means that a majority of primary voters in every state have preferred somebody else.
Right.
The problem is the rest of that vote has been splintered and continues to be splintered. It certainly was in Michigan. And so if it were just Trump versus anybody, it's not completely clear whether that anybody would be able to get a majority if, in fact, Trump's ceiling is below 50%, or whether or not, as Pete points out, some of that vote would go to Trump. And that part we don't know yet. And given the fact that all of the remaining Republican candidates think that all of the other remaining Republican candidates should drop out of the race, it seems like that's not likely anytime soon.
And I think for the Stop Trump movement, that's the strength of leaving those candidates who are pulling 20, 25, 28% of the vote. Leaving multiple candidates in keeps Donald Trump low. I think if you were to move to one candidate versus Trump, that's a very high risk of Donald Trump actually winning majorities, which sends a different kind of message than just winning meaningful pluralities.
But let's look at Michigan here for a moment, because this might be a little microcosm of how this could play out. We don't have the alternate universe to know what would have happened if it had been simply Ted Cruz against Donald Trump. But Ted Cruz put in not a lot of time here personally. He had a pretty good organization, but not a lot of time here personally. It came for the debate and did a last-minute rally in Grand Rapids. I think the previous time he was in Michigan before that was in October when he was at Wing Stadium. John Kasich, as he joked, if he had been here any longer, would have had to pay taxes. and they ended up essentially tied. Cruz did a little bit better, but he got the same number of delegates. At the end of the day, does that maybe cut into what Trump could have got in terms of delegates, and therefore, in other words, if Kasich had not put his chips on the table as much here, would that have maybe given Donald Trump more delegates and pushed him a little further along the path to a majority if he could get it?
I think so. When even if we look at the polling that was done in the last few days leading into the primary, there was a certain percentage of every candidate's supporters who said that their second choice was Donald Trump. So if you just kind of add up those percentages bit by bit, Donald Trump's support does tend to increase incrementally.
And it's interesting to me the way that this this contest has been covered. If you only watched national news, you might think that Donald Trump was already the Republican nominee.
Yes.
It's been so difficult for any other candidate to get any oxygen in this climate, including on Tuesday night after the polls closed and the results started coming in. And so, again, as we think about the narrative and the way that your success affects the future narrative, the narrative has now for weeks been a narrative of Trump, 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 and the fact that now there's this, anti-Trump movement moving, and in many ways only reinforces him. I mean, these are people that don't like the Republican establishment. Many of them don't think of themselves as Republicans. Not all of them, certainly, but many of them don't think of themselves as Republicans.
His best support comes from people who are alienated from the Republican Party and who are angry at the government generally.
Which is interesting, again, an interesting comparison across parties, because in many ways Sanders' support taps into that same vein of anger and fear and frustration in a different way, certainly. But you know, we see that going on in this election cycle in both parties in a way that we don't usually. Sometimes we see it in one party or the other. This time around, it's in both. That reflects, I think, this larger concern that that folks that pay attention to government politics ought to have, and that is that, you know, government's unresponsive, and there are some reasons why, and maybe we ought to start thinking about addressing those reasons.
Well, and I think that that's an exactly correct parallel is what's going on. That the things that are feeding Donald Trump's candidacy are the same things that are feeding Bernie Sanders' candidacy. What's interesting is that where it breaks down is in terms of the solutions that they're proposing. Donald Trump's solutions are simple, giving simple answers to complex questions. It's a very, very strong nationalism and projecting strength and power, whereas Bernie Sanders says the solution here is to use the power of the federal government to solve these problems, which is two very different kinds of solutions to a similar kind of discontent.
In some ways, that reflects differences between the Republican and Democratic parties, but it also reflects the field of candidates and sort of who you're running against. And in all of these contests, you know, when you go to the polling place to vote, you've got a defined set of candidates to vote for. That shapes the way that these things play out.
I want to go back for one more moment on the whole idea of the Stop Trump thing, because if you are going to have, going forward, multiple candidates stay in the race, again, looking at what John Kasich did in Michigan, it took a lot of effort to get close to Ted Cruz. Does that mean that there are people out there who normally write big checks to Republican candidates who will have to write them to people like John Kasich, knowing that his path to the Republican nomination is very convoluted? It means a brokered convention and John Kasich, who finishes third at best out of everybody, getting the nomination. I mean, I guess I'm just wondering if that becomes a tough sell for people who normally fund campaigns. Hey, we need you to support a candidate whose odds of winning are infinitesimal at this point.
I think the big donors, and John might be able to speak to this more authoritatively, but it seems to me that the big donors have long-term interests of the party in mind in addition to just winning the next election. Look, if the big donors are only focused on the presidential election, they've got an uphill battle. But they're also concerned about retaining Congress. And so the battle for Congress, retaining the Senate, retaining the House, I think if Donald Trump becomes the presidential candidate for the Republicans, that's where we'll see a lot of that money flow, is to ensuring that those seats in Congress stay in Republican hands.
And a lot of these folks that have the big pocketbooks have already invested a lot of money in this campaign, and it hasn't paid out very well for them. And so as a result, I think some of them will be sort of gun-shy about that. And I think Peter's right that as we look at governing rather than just the presidential contest, what really is going to make a difference is what happens in the House and the Senate. Now, that only comes up from candidates that are sort of establishment candidates. So, you know, Hillary Clinton can talk about her relationships in the Senate, and John Kasich, as a former congressman, can talk about, working, how one works as an executive like a governor with a legislature in order to accomplish goals. They can make that case. That's a complicated case. Most folks really don't want to pay attention to that. A Bernie Sanders, a Donald Trump, less clear that they would have the support of even members of the Democratic and Republican parties in Congress, less clear what would happen. And we've seen in several states that have elected independents as governors and people that don't have strong party ties, that sometimes there's a real difficulty for them to move policy. And if that's the case, and you're a big donor of some kind, you may want to turn your attention away from the presidential contest and think about what happens on Capitol Hill instead.
Yes.
This primary in Michigan set a record for turnout. There were 2.5 million voters who cast a ballot one way or another. The old record had stood since 1972, which is kind of surprising. I know Michigan's lost population in the last few years, but there was growth in population before that. So does that indicate some heightened interest and perhaps the fact that we have candidates who are maybe bringing new voters in who in the past would have stayed home for a presidential primary?
Yeah, I think that clearly seems to be the pattern. And it's mainly working on the Republican side nationwide. I mean, certainly all of the Republican primary electorates have been larger this year than they have been in the previous couple of cycles. Democrats are harder to compare here in Michigan because, of course, the last time we had contested Democratic primary in 2008, Michigan was really off the table. And so I looked back at these numbers to try to figure out what was going on in 2008. It's just really hard to pin down. But certainly the Democratic turnout was up from that year. And there was a lot of excitement here, but nationwide, in general, Democratic turnout has been down substantially.
And in Michigan, there's only been one time since 1972 that the Democrats have used the state-run primary to select their convention delegates. And so in that way, it becomes a difficult comparison as well. And 1992 was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
At least in politics.
One thing I wonder, with both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump doing well in Michigan and it seemingly going on for a while in contested primaries and Donald Trump being the front runner, a big issue in Michigan is trade policy. Does this bring trade policy into the mix in a way that previously maybe it never got a lot of attention, at least beyond maybe the Democratic primary? Does it now become an issue that could come up in the general election?
I think it certainly could. We saw in 2012 the whole issue of the auto bailout for the auto industry became an important issue, and that was a Michigan-based issue that resonated in lots of other places, especially in Ohio, but in places all around the country. And it was an issue where President Obama was able to really put some distance between himself and Mitt Romney. In part because the policy seemed to have been working at that point. We'd had enough time in between when that bailout occurred and when the election took place. Now, interestingly, it's resurfaced again on the Democratic side in a way that I think, frankly, has not been very helpful to Hillary Clinton. But it seems as though her campaign thinks it's an issue where she can put some space between herself and Bernie Sanders. I think it's backfiring on her, frankly. But again, it is an issue. It resonates not only, if we think about manufacturing more broadly, not just in trade policy, but in terms of support of government for manufacturing. That's going to be an important issue again on the Democratic side. And it potentially at least sets up some clear distinctions, although we really don't know where Donald Trump stands on this kind of stuff.
Right. But I think in terms of the Democrats, what's interesting is, that, again, looking at the exit polls from Michigan, is that among the Democrats who thought that trade takes away American jobs, Bernie Sanders won those Democrats. And for those Democrats who thought that trade creates jobs, Hillary Clinton won those.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to have to ask you both for a quick comment on this last thing, but I want to note somebody who was not on the ballot Tuesday, Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, and to think back of where things were with him a year ago. We were talking about him as a potential presidential candidate. Since then, there was the failed road funding ballot issue, which now it doesn't seem to come up very often, but was kind of hanging over him, and then the Flint water crisis. How unusual is it to see someone's political star go so dim? If I can have you both kind of wrap that up in about 30 seconds, John?
Well, it happens a lot, and you can ask all of the failed candidates in the presidential race about that, because, they're in part, what makes people successful in politics is that they're successful in politics. Once you change that narrative, it's hard to get it back.
And I think that it ultimately will hurt the Republicans, because it's such an important kind of fundamental issue about what government ought to be taken care of. And just the fact that he's a Republican means that it's going to hurt them. If they ever had a shot at Michigan in the general, this really would hurt it.
John Clark and Peter Rehlhauer, thank you very much for your time.
Thank Always
you,
a pleasure.
I think we need to talk again in the fall, don't we?
Absolutely. Maybe even before then.
Maybe. Maybe we should plan on it. John Clark and Peter Rehlhauer are both professors of political science at Western Michigan University. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.